From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tiger, Tiger burned bright at last weekend's U.S. Open, but we won't see his immortal hand-eye coordination until next January at the earliest. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll explore the effect Tiger's absence will have on the 2008 PGA Tour. Also, John Feinstein talks about his new book, Living on the Black, Two Pitchers, Two Teams, One Season to Remember. Also ahead, the Seattle Mariners wash out while the Tampa Bay Rays are making the case that they're no longer bottom feeders.
We just got to ride this wave until it crashes. And hopefully it doesn't crash for a while.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For 11 seasons, Tampa Bay has had a Major League Baseball team. The ball club's shining moment occurred in 2004 when they finished fourth in the five-team American League East. In each of the other years, Tampa Bay has finished last. But this spring, playing for the first time as the Rays rather than the Devil Rays, the team is in second place, tucked just behind the Red Sox and ahead of the Yankees. On Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday nights, they beat the Chicago Cubs, currently the leaders in the National League Central Division. Gary Glover, a pitcher in his second season with Tampa Bay, says the chemistry on this year's club is terrific.
Well, I definitely feel that it's a lot more of a team, this year than last. I mean, you know, just the unity that is here, people are pulling for each other. It's not an individual basis anymore. You know, everybody's playing for one common goal, and that's to win, and that's what makes a team.
The addition of veterans Cliff Floyd and Troy Percival has brought maturity to what had been a very young and sometimes volatile aggregation. When I suggested to Gary Glover that addition could sometimes occur via subtraction, too, his answer was excruciatingly diplomatic.
I won't go and say that you're wrong in that, but I'm not going to elaborate any further on that either as well.
Okay, I'll do the elaborating. Before the 08 season began, Tampa Bay traded Delmon Young to the Twins. Though he was runner-up for Rookie of the Year last season, as a AAA player, Young was suspended for 50 games when he flipped a bat and hit an umpire in the chest. It was the second time he'd been suspended for going after an umpire. Also among the exiled is Elijah Dukes, a promising outfielder currently with the Nationals. His wife filed a restraining order against him last spring after he'd sent a photograph of a gun to her cell phone and threatened to kill her and her children. Whether it's the absence of Young, Dukes, and various other former Rays, or the presence of the aforementioned veterans, according to pitcher Andy Sonnenstein, coming to the ballpark in Tampa is more fun than it used to be.
The biggest thing for me is the clubhouse has been a great place to come to before you have a ball game to play, and everybody's relaxed in here and joking around and having a good time, and I think that's a big thing for us to win.
In only his second season as a major leaguer, Sonnenstein, 25, leads the team in wins with 8. The aforementioned Troy Percival, who'll be 39 this summer, is on a pace to save more than 30 games. Among the relatively few players who've been with the Rays long enough to appreciate the difference between the bad old days and the current season is Carl Crawford, who's hit over 300 three times in his 6-plus seasons with Tampa Bay. Injuries have recently limited Crawford, and he's hitting 30 points below his career average this year, but he's enjoying what the youngsters on the club have been accomplishing.
They knew about the history, but they didn't really go through it, and it's a difference when you didn't actually go through it. So these guys actually believe in that they belong at the top, so it's that's why it's so weird for me to see, because I've seen both sides now, and it's a nice thing. It's a beautiful thing. So I've been having the most fun I've had in my whole career, so I just hope we continue to do it.
Among those who think the Rays can continue to do it is Mark Lancaster, who covers the team for the Tampa Tribune.
Yeah, I think so. And the reason is it's not like they've been riding an offensive hot streak to this point that they're at right now. I mean, and I think offense is something that really has a tendency to come and go. I mean, they've gotten good pitching and good defense. Their defense was basically the worst by one measurement, the worst in the last 50 years by Baseball Prospectus last season. And now they're right at the top of Major League Baseball as far as, you know, the range and the number of balls they get to. And that makes a huge difference for the pitching staff just because, you know, they're more confident letting balls get hit in play, and therefore they walk less guys. And You know, that kind of thing is, I think, a little more sustainable than would be if you're out there winning 8-6 every night.
One of the many areas in which the Rays have historically failed is attendance, though their average is up about 2,000 to 19,000 a night this season. On the rare occasions when there have been a lot of people in the building, most of those people have been rooting for the visiting Red Sox or Yankees, or, as was the case to some extent this week, for the visiting Cubs. Though it may be strange to play home games where many of the fans are rooting for the opposition, Mark Lancaster feels the dynamic of the stadium has been changed by the home team's improvement.
It is a little jarring, but at the same time, it's, you know, it wasn't a complete shock to anybody just because they've seen it before so often around here. But I think once the game, you know, got tight during the finish, and, you know, the Cubs fans made a lot of noise in the ninth inning when the Cubs were trying to rally, but then the Rays fans sort of responded when the Rays ended up closing out the game and winning it. So, you know, that's one thing that they've noticed as a phenomenon down here is that even if there seems to be a lot of opposing fans going, if the Rays come back and win late, or if they, you know, have something exciting happen for the Rays late, that suddenly some of those fans seem to switch over and it gets a lot louder for the Rays at the end.
A lot louder is no surprise for this second-place club, especially considering that they've only finished higher than last place once, ever. Present success has encouraged in pitcher Andy Sonnenstein both optimism and a certain caution.
You know, we just got to ride this wave until it crashes. And hopefully it doesn't crash for a while.
The Rays host the Houston Astros this evening and tomorrow afternoon, two games during which they'll hope to keep riding the wave and providing more reinforcement for Tampa Bay fans gradually learning how to cheer for a winner. Unlike the Rays, the guys playing for the Seattle Mariners are probably anticipating the summer part of the summer game with resignation, or at least the optimists among them are. The pessimists are already knee-deep in dread. The Mariners beat the Texas Rangers 5-2 on opening day, and that was the day they peaked. Seattle went 12-15 in April and 8-20 in May. They began June by losing four straight. Joining me now is David Andreessen, who follows the Mariners for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. David, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
The Mariners have the worst record in the major leagues by a lot, so it's no surprise that some of the people theoretically responsible for that record have been fired. How stands the carnage?
Well, at this point, we have lost a hitting coach, and then this week we lost the general manager, and then 3 days later, the manager. So the great irony is that they keep saying again and again that the players are the most responsible, that they bear the ultimate responsibility, that they have to get it together, and yet the players all have their jobs, so it's a little bit ironic.
At the news conference announcing Monday's firing of general manager Bill Bavese, he bravely stayed around and took questions. He was asked why pitcher Eric Bedard couldn't throw more than 100 pitches a game, and Bavese said, quote, "You've got to ask him, and he's going to give some dumbass answer for you." I guess there's nothing like being fired to provoke candor, huh?
You know, I've never admired Bill more than in that moment, I have to say. The Bedard deal was really the one that Bill risked his standing on. He traded a lot of the farm system for that. He thought that was the piece that was really going to put them over the top. And once Eric got here, he discovered, we all discovered that Eric wasn't quite the character guy that we thought. He just seems generally disinterested. He won't talk to the media at all, and he just doesn't have the passion that you'd like to see, and I think that very much frustrated Bill, and so he took a swipe at him on the way out the door.
That wasn't the only bizarre moment during that particular press conference, was it?
Bill was very open about the things that were going on, very open about individual guys, and we appreciate that. It was actually a little surprising to hear because Bill was not the most available general manager that we've ever dealt with. He was a guy who wasn't around a lot, didn't talk a lot, so to hear him talk so openly was kind of nice, and I give him a lot of credit for showing up even to do that. I mean, who else is going to stick around after they're fired to do an exit interview?
That's an excellent point, and at one point, Bavese said of the players that they had, quote, learned how to become dysfunctional. Does that seem a reasonable explanation for what's happened in Seattle?
Well, they're absolutely dysfunctional. I've never seen a more dysfunctional team, and I've been doing this for a lot of years. They just don't seem to click. They don't seem to get along as people or as teammates. And, you know, they say all the right things, and I think they genuinely are working hard. I don't think you can fault most people on this team for not working hard, but as Bill kind of explained, they get white line fever. They cross the white line, and then it just all comes apart on them, and it seems to happen every night.
On Wednesday, Mariners manager John McLaren, I should now say ex-manager John McLaren, announced that Ichiro Suzuki, Seattle seven-time All-Star, would return to right field, but I don't suppose that's why he was fired the next day.
No. In fact, the interim general manager, Lee Pelikudas, said that he agreed with that move and had no problem with it. It was a curious move in a procedural sense, in a making out the lineup sense. It doesn't make a whole lot of logic. So we'll see if the Mariners stick with that. But John did that apparently unilaterally, and he and Ichiro are very close, and Ichiro prefers right field, and I think it was just sort of a gift that he extended to Ichiro in hopes that it would spark him, because Ichiro, even by his own standards, is lagging a little bit behind this year. Now we just have to see if the new manager will agree to be stuck with that.
Now, I don't want to give our listeners the impression that the season has been a total bust. Dave Niehaus has been doing play-by-play for the Mariners for 31 years, and apparently Dave Niehaus bobblehead night is coming up.
Yeah, it's about time. Dave is actually going into the Hall of Fame next month. He's going to be inducted into the broadcaster's wing, having received the Ford C. Frick Award this year. So they're honoring him. He's been with the club from the very beginning. And I'll be traveling with him to Cooperstown next month. So it's at this point, he might be the most popular Mariner.
Especially after the bobblehead doll comes out, I would think.
Yeah, there you go.
How are fans in Seattle reacting to this ongoing train wreck of a season?
With a lot of frustration and even some anger. This city was so spoiled by the 2001 team that won a record 116 games. Really, you know, sparked a passion, got people going, and then in recent years they endured three straight last place finishes. And last year they won 88 games, and people thought, okay, here we go, we're coming back. They really, you know, went for it, talked huge this spring, talked, you know, big about how they were going to be contenders, and anything less than a division title would be a disappointment. And then just to do this has been really, really disappointing. And as with any team in these dire straits, the fans start calling for heads earlier than they actually start to roll. So it builds some frustration with, you know, why is Bavese still here? Particularly Bavese, I think people like McLaren more. But, yeah, people are angry, and we've got the Sonics trial going on here at the same time. So it's just generally a bad time to be a Seattle sports fan.
Is there any reason to think the Mariners can salvage anything from this season?
No, this season is done. So I think their best plan now is just to plan for next year, get a look at some of their young guys. Hopefully they'll cut some of their dead weight as far as guys who are underperforming that aren't coming back next year anyway, and just see what we have for the future. I think that's what the fans would most appreciate, too.
David Andreessen covers the Mariners for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. David, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Rob! That is Rob, on a pirate ship. If you drink too much, the ship will tip. Drinking Rob, on a pirate ship, you better share.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
My cat's got a fingertip steering wheel. It's got gold-plated golf mats.
High-tech golf carts recently introduced at the West Midlands Golf Club in Great Britain include computers that tell players how far they've hit their drives, as well as the remaining distance to the pin. The on-cart computers also enable players to order drinks from the bar so that their libations will be waiting for them when they get to the 19th hole. So that there will be no bother about reaching said destination, each of the new carts is equipped with a satellite navigation system programmed with a map of the course so that golfers unable to find their way from each green to the next tee will be saved the embarrassment of getting lost. Reports that the carts also dress the golfers and tie their shoelaces have proven to be exaggerated. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the end of golf as we have come to know it, or at least the temporary suspension of same. But first,
thank God I've seen the Patriots, the Red Sox, and the Celtics win in my lifetime. Now, if I pass away, I'll feel great.
Such is the result of living in a city where the professional sports teams have been winning, at least as Jamal Jones of Dorchester, Massachusetts sees it. He was celebrating the NBA Finals triumph of the Boston Celtics over the Los Angeles Lakers on Tuesday night. Of course, for every fan inclined to see the glass as overflowing, there's bound to be one complaining that it's only half full. Enter Robert Hazelwood of Jamaica Plain.
I'm just really pissed off the Pats didn't win the Super Bowl. What are you going to do? 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Not bad at all. The aforementioned Pats were beaten by the Giants in Super Bowl XLII a few months ago, but they'd won 3 of the previous 6 Super Bowls. Late Tuesday night, the Celts assumed the champion's mantle for the first time in 22 years. The Red Sox are Major League Baseball's defending champs. Was ever the same group of fans so lavishly rewarded? Rhetorical question. We'll have more on the NBA Finals when I speak with Charlie Pierce a little later in the program. On Monday, Tiger Woods shocked practically nobody by winning a major golf tournament, the U.S. Open. It was the 14th time that he'd won a major. 2 days later, he shocked almost everybody by announcing that he will not play golf again until January. He'll be having knee surgery again. Joining me now to discuss perhaps the most significant development in golf since the digging of the first hole is Michael Rosenberg, a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Michael, welcome back to Only Again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, do I have that about right? Is Tiger missing the rest of the year pretty much the biggest story in golf since, well, ever?
You know, we're getting to the point now where when he wins, we expect it. So, yeah, I guess it's bigger that he's not playing. It's going to be an ongoing lurking presence that we're going to have at all these tournaments that there's no Tiger there, and we're kind of wondering why we're watching.
Of course, winning the U.S. Open with a torn ACL and a double stress fracture in his left leg has sort of raised Tiger to the level of saint, or at the very least martyr, for some sports fans. Maybe it's time to get out the holy water.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. You have to wonder if you're one of the other golfers. You're going, okay, now he couldn't walk, and he still beat all of us. What do we do now? You know, do we take away his clubs to see if he can sort of Jedi mind trick the ball into the hole maybe in like 63 shots for a round? I don't know what you do at this point, except you just say, hey, if I'm going to win a tournament, maybe I should do it in the next few months while he's rehabbing.
I have to mention here that two-time U.S. Open champion Retief Hoosen suggested that Tiger might be faking the whole thing. He later recanted that accusation, and that's a good thing because otherwise there might be a blasphemy trial in the works even as we speak.
Yeah, the old fake knee surgery and miss the rest of the season, you don't see that one very often. I think probably good that Goosen recanted. But I think that does show you how amazing it is what Tiger did, that the other golfers just didn't believe it. They figured he must be fake.
There is no doubt that the absence of Tiger Woods will have an effect on the tour, obviously. Perhaps PGA Tour veteran Kenny Perry put it best, or at least most concisely, when he said simply, Tiger is our tour. How different will the PGA Tour be for all that time that Tiger won't be present?
Well, I guess let me put it to you this way. If the E Street Band was playing down the block from me, I would go see him. But I would just look around going, where's Bruce? How can there be no Bruce Springsteen here? And that's pretty much where the PGA Tour is right now. No matter what any of these guys does, we're just going to wonder, Tiger might have been 10 strokes better than the guy who won the tournament. It's just he's been so dominant, and it's weird that he hasn't really elevated the interest in golf. He's just elevated the interest in Tiger. So now we've got golf with no Tiger, and we're kind of like, why are we watching?
Well, that's a point that you made in an article you wrote recently. People assumed that there are more golfers in the U.S. as Tiger's popularity has grown, but in fact, the number of golfers has actually dropped. Tiger is more popular, but the game, not so much.
Right, and that's really not his fault, but he's just dwarfed everything. That the International out in Colorado was not his kind of tournament, so he didn't play it. There is no International anymore. It just vanished. So there's basically, that's pretty good proof that there is no golf without Tiger, and now we've got to deal with golf without Tiger. So we'll see how the PGA does. It's a good thing they've got their television money guaranteed already.
Yeah, that is a real worry, because although you have said you would go see the E Street Band even if Bruce Springsteen wasn't there, how many other people are going to watch the PGA tournaments either on TV or in person without the presence of the star?
It might be a little roomy. It might be when you're by the ropes there at the tournament, you might feel like you can stretch out a little bit. It might be a little different.
All right, but other PGA pros must be salivating over this development. No Tiger at the British Open, no Tiger at the PGA Championship. This means somebody else is finally going to have a chance to run away with all the money, power, glory, fame, and adoration, right?
They are going to have a chance to win the tournament. Unfortunately, when we list the winners later, their name will be in parentheses. That's just how we're going to do it. But, they're going to have a chance to win the tournament. And they can tell their grandkids they won the British, and when the kid says, well, how'd Tiger do, then you just sort of pretend you have a bad cell phone connection at that point, and you can't answer the question.
So the dreaded asterisk will be there, and it'll mean W-O-T, without Tiger.
Yeah, that's just the nature of it. And I guess, you know, in a way it's justice for these guys, because they had the misfortune of being born in the same generation as Tiger in the first place. How many guys have missed out on a major because of that? So now they have kind of a reprieve for two majors where they have a chance.
When Tiger's limp first became apparent, some people were saying that at least he should be healthy by the time the Ryder Cup rolled around in September, but now it's clear that even the mighty Tiger can't heal from ACL surgery that quickly. So should the American team just stay home?
You know, it's weird. I actually think they may have a little better chance. Tiger, the one gap in his whole resume is that his Ryder Cup record's not very good, and the Americans are always his heavy favorite. It's kind of like, you would think the media would learn by now. Every 2 years, we make the Americans a heavy favorite, and then 4 days later, the Europeans are celebrating, and 2 years later, we come back and make the Americans a heavy favorite again. So maybe having that pressure off of them will help the Americans, and they can actually win the thing.
Win one for Tiger. I can hear it now.
I know these guys respect Tiger. I'm not sure that they need to win for him. He's probably won enough for himself, you know?
In all seriousness now, will you miss Tiger when you tune into golf tournaments over the next year or so?
Yeah, you know, we have the Buick Open in Michigan next week, and then we have PGA here in August, and all of a sudden I got to work a lot harder to come up with some column ideas. There's no doubt you're going to miss him. I would think if you're a golf fan at all, even if you're a Phil guy, you'll miss seeing Tiger out there. He just has such a magnetism that it changes everything. Even if you didn't like Michael Jordan, you got to admit the NBA was not the same when he left the Bulls.
Michael Rosenberg is a columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Michael, thank you very much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
One doesn't necessarily assume that horseback pleasure riding on quaint New England trails would bring a person closer to Africa. But a retired teacher and equestrian enthusiast is doing her best to bring those worlds together via fundraisers, which, though they may not raise the largest amount of money, do go a long way toward fulfilling a very substantial vision. Amy Mayer reports from Groton, Massachusetts, site of the annual African Safari Ride.
Judy Lorimer's 20-year-old Toyota sits in the shade with the hatch open. Dixie cups of water and iced tea are ready for hot, thirsty riders. Horses will drink from blue plastic buckets Lorimer filled with water from the nearby pond.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. You're the first ones through.
Yeah.
Here at the snack stop, horses get cooled down with sponges because it's well over 90 degrees. This annual African safari ride attracted 16 riders this year. Lorimer co-sponsors it with the Littleton Horse Owners Association, and it's affiliated with New England Horse and Trail, a pleasure riding network that helps Lorimer pull in participants from around the region. Lorimer's been a rider all her life. She first traveled to Mali, West Africa, with her dance teacher in 1996. Since then, she's returned at least once every year. Many of the villages she visits in southern Mali have only elementary schools, some with outdoor classrooms. The fundraising began in 2002 after Lorimer's travels inspired a high school senior in need of a service project.
I was taking school supplies to a little private school over there, and she had seen pictures of the school, which was pretty ramshackle. And she decided for her project that she'd like to try to raise money to build them a new school.
Together, Lorimer and her students sponsored a performance of African dance and drumming. It became an annual event. When the first $10,000 was raised, Lorimer went back to Africa with more than pencils and paper.
I went to Mali to spend a month as a volunteer for Save the Children. And I was so impressed by what they had done in terms of building schools and providing community gardens and digging wells and things like that, that I asked them if they would be interested in getting $10,000 to help build a school, and they of course accepted.
The village of Dilo Koroba got its middle school in 2005. One of its students is a girl who Lorimer has sponsored for several years.
Her name is Sitan Kone. She's a delightful little girl, and she is now a seventh grader at the first school that we built in collaboration with Save the Children.
Lorimer has hand-delivered money for new schools twice since 2005 and has volunteered to help build them. She says masonry and other skilled jobs are done by appropriate contractors, but that still leaves plenty of work.
The labor, like carting the sand and gravel in donkey carts, and the women carry the water to mix with the cement and buckets on their heads, and all that unskilled labor is part of the community's contribution.
Lorimer says that often for Malians to get beyond sixth grade, students have to commute or board. That isn't practical for many. Lorimer's nonprofit, Build a School in Africa, will contribute to its fourth school, hopefully this year, in the village of Giaka, not far from a town called Kabila.
Kabila is vastly overcrowded. Its middle school has over 100 students per class. So this will hopefully take a lot of the burden off of Kabila, and the local kids from the local villages will be able to have a middle school education without having to be crammed into a seat with four other kids.
Lorimer has devoted her retirement from kindergarten teaching to building schools in Mali, one of the poorest countries in the world. Her commitment stems largely from the impact the new schools have on girls, who often left school after sixth grade because leaving home to board in the city for middle school didn't appeal to their families.
Girls who are educated tend to marry later, have fewer children, and tend to have healthier children. All over the world, this is what happens when you educate your girls.
After a few hours, with under 4 miles to go in today's trail ride, Darlene Olson rides into the stop with three others.
Great ride!
Lorimer says at $50 for both days, a pleasure ride like this is the bargain of the equestrian world.
Things like 100 paces charge $45 for a 6 or 7 mile ride and no food. Dressage tests, I don't even know what they cost. They're just out of sight. Combined training, showing half a dozen classes and you've dropped $100 or $150.
Though riders shoulder high fuel and feed prices, they are happy to pay a little extra for Lorimer's ride to support the cause. Roberta Shaw and her horse Tigger came down from Milford, New Hampshire.
We try to support a couple of benefit rides, you know, each year, and this is one of them that we try really hard to always do because we think it's an incredible, worthwhile benefit that she runs here.
As horses and riders finish, they're greeted by Dennis Kelly's thoroughbred Gabby. Riders cool their horses and give them water and food. Then it's their turn to eat. Lorimer has worked for days to prepare the African feast that awaits them.
Well, I think Judy's done wonderfully in that. What, you've built three schools and you're on your fourth?
Yep.
I think that is commendable.
On the deck of the house, a table is spread with four crock pots and a rice cooker, and this crowd of mostly middle-aged, mostly female diners loads their plastic plates and sits down in the shady spots.
What do we have here, Judy?
We have mchusi wa mboga, which is a vegetable stew with eggplant and sweet potatoes, carrots, bunch of stuff.
Gorgeous colors.
And this is
Marty Guile digs in.
I think this lunch is fabulous. So delicious. The curry's my favorite, but everything else is so good. And I've been looking forward to this because I came to this ride, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. So I remember how good the food was. So I've been looking forward to coming back. Plus, the trail ride itself was fabulous. The trails are beautiful.
That's true.
After lunch, Guild and the other day riders load horses into trailers for the drive home. In the evening, Lorimer will pop in this DVD of an African Rhythms performance to entertain the two-day riders. Today's trail ride brings in a few hundred dollars, but Lorimer will still be a couple thousand dollars shy of the goal for this year's new school. She'll keep at it, though, adding whatever other fundraisers she can. For Only a Game, I'm Amy Mayer in Groton, Massachusetts.
You're listening to Only a Game. Sometimes a listener sends an email to Only a Game that isn't about anything he or she has heard on the program. Sometimes it's just a comment on how things might have been different. Amusing of that nature came in this week from John White, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore. "Call me naive," Mr. White wrote, "but I can't help thinking what a fine gesture it would have been for Tiger Woods to have allowed Rocco Mediate to win their playoff in the U.S. Open. Thrown the match, in other words. Tiger already had a bunch of major trophies. This was surely Rocco's one shot, and just think what the trophy would have meant to him." Not so much, perhaps, if he'd somehow intuited that Woods was throwing the match, but I see your point, though it may have evaporated, given that Mr. Woods announced on Wednesday that surgery on his injured knee will keep him off the golf course for the remainder of the summer. C.C. Graham, who hears the program on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, wrote to comment on the ignorance evident in my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week. "We both thought that Zara Phillips, the daughter of the Princess of England, should have bought another horse when hers turned up lame, thus foiling her Olympic plans. Surely money couldn't have been the issue." "Your comment was funny but ill-informed," Ms. Graham wrote. "She has other horses in different stages of training, but just as in pairs figure skating, the rider and horse qualify as a pair. If one goes down, the other goes down too, and finding another partner is not an option." Speaking of horses, Bob Chubon of Columbia, South Carolina, wrote of last week's show, "I listened intently to hear some commentary on the day Big Brown bombed. Nary a word, how quickly losers are forgotten." Charlie and I did discuss Big Brown's performance at the Belmont Stakes and the response of the horse's trainer. Any more would have been piling on, wouldn't it? Several listeners wrote to compliment John Kalish for his story about stickball in New York. That story, which was on the program 2 weeks ago, provoked Suzanne Barkin, who hears only a game on Vermont Public Radio, to call her 78-year-old father to make sure he was listening. She wrote, "Dad used to tell me that if you used anything other than a broken broom handle, it wasn't stickball. It was a great feature, just like the game, fun for the whole family, especially ones from New York, so, gee, thanks." Write us with your comments, corrections, or encouragement at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
If you think competition has to be physical, think again. The Great American Think-Off, a national philosophy competition purporting to give ordinary people the opportunity to debate various questions, awarded its gold medal to Craig Allen on Saturday for his argument that current immigration policy in the U.S. is, quote, broken. The silver medal went to Dina Cavalieri, who thinks immigrants of diverse cultures have helped make America an innovative and wealthy country. One of the two bronze medal winners maintained that immigration makes the U.S. stronger, while the other contended that immigration threatens the country. I think the judges were going out of their way to be impartial. What do I win? I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. It may have other authors of sports-based books bawling, but John Feinstein strikes again. Get it? But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
That was terrible.
I'm sorry. But which is the bigger story? Tiger Woods wins the U.S. Open on a broken leg and torn ligament, or Tiger Woods won't play golf again until January?
Tiger Woods won't play golf again until January. That's a huge—I mean, as great as the win at Torrey Pines was, this is a huge development. He's really hurt. I mean, this is no longer a kind of twinge that gets you pretty good video when he hits the ball off the tee. This is a very serious knee injury he has now. And everybody in a lot of network suites and corporate offices, and to say nothing of the home office of the PGA, is holding their chest. This knocks him out of the Ryder Cup. This knocks him out of, well, frankly, every tournament, probably until next year's Masters.
Though they probably won't acknowledge it, numbers of pro golfers probably see Tiger's absence as an opportunity. There are, however, some people interested in golf who've announced that they're not unhappy that Mr. Woods will be taking a break.
Yes, the British bookies are going to make a little bit of money. You know, they get longer odds, they get more people winning tournaments, and they don't have people putting down a bob, a quid, a huppence, a tuppence, a thruppence, a buppence, a bup-a-da-ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba on Tiger Woods. They can bet a whole bunch of those on someone else.
Since Tuesday, when the Boston Celtics overwhelmed the Los Angeles Lakers in Game 6 of the NBA Finals to win the championship, some observers have been ranking the 07-08 Celts among the top championship teams that have worn green. Do the current champs deserve that sort of acclaim?
Oh, certainly. I mean, they were wire-to-wire winners. They won 66 games. They won the NBA championship in six games. They were responsible for the greatest one-season turnaround in NBA history. They were responsible for the greatest one-game turnaround in NBA playoff history. Mm-hmm. And they were responsible for the greatest margin of victory in a deciding game in the history of the league. Yeah, they are in the conversation of the top 5 to 10 teams that were ever put together.
This week in Seattle, the trial that will determine whether the Seattle Supersonics is underway. How much do you suppose it's going to cost Sonics owner Clay Bennett to convince the owners of Key Arena to allow him to leave town?
Oh, man, I don't think you can count that high. There is so much ill feeling and bad faith swirling around this story that I think that I'm surprised they haven't had to apply to a change of venue to the moon. I can't imagine there's any way they can get any kind of jury in Seattle to go along with this guy.
The NBA draft will take place Thursday in New York. This year's conscription seems to be getting much less attention than last year's, but maybe that's just because you and I aren't in Chicago.
Well, that's true. The Bulls will likely take Derrick Rose, since the fad this year, even though this is a very center-heavy draft, particularly among the foreign players, the fad this year will be to take guards because of what Chris Paul did in New Orleans. The most intriguing team among the top five is the Minnesota Timberwolves. The safe pick for them would probably be Kevin Love out of UCLA. They seem to be flirting with the notion of O.J. Mayo, who I think is a catastrophe waiting to happen.
Less than an hour before the deadline for underclassmen to withdraw from the NBA draft, the coach of the University of North Carolina men's basketball team, Roy Williams, got some great news, or at least I'm assuming it was great news.
Yes, three of his players are coming back to play again next year. Ty Lawson, Wayne Ellington, and Danny Green, none of whom would have been drafted very high, to be perfectly honest with you. Lawson's probably the best of them, and he's a 5'11" point guard, but he's got ankle trouble, and I think all three of them made smart moves.
Former New York Mets manager Willie Randolph said this week that he felt his firing was, quote, abrupt. Is he the only one who thinks so?
Well, I think in the sense that getting fired at 3 o'clock in the morning by email is abrupt. Yes, it is abrupt. But unexpected? No, not at all. He got to the playoffs. He didn't win anything. He got the greatest collapse in the history of his team last year. They were not off to a good start. He's got a huge payroll. He's got lunatic owners. He's a scapegoat. Omar Minaya, by the way, better turn off his computer after midnight because you never know.
Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania announced this week that he will not seek hearings to further investigate the videotaping practices of the New England Patriots. Senator Specter said the Senate Judiciary Committee, quote, already has too much to do. And so, I put it to you, sir, is there any place for a sensible declaration like that in the U.S. Senate?
Well, not just that, but did the Judiciary Committee get, like, really busy in the last 2 weeks? This is all, they've always had too much to do rather than investigate this nonsense.
I second that notion. The Jockey Club established a safety panel after 8 Bell's Kentucky Derby breakdown and subsequent destruction. This week, that panel called for a steroid ban in thoroughbred racing. Is that a good idea, a steroid ban?
Presumably, we're talking about giving the horses steroids.
That's
right?
What I understand.
It would defeat the purpose,
yes.
Giving it to the jockeys, because then they'd get really big.
They'd get big and too heavy.
I suspect it probably is a pretty good idea. I hope they're doing this in a calm, rational way and not just panicking because of what happened to 8 Bell's, but I'm not optimistic about that at all.
After paying off a $400,000 gambling debt incurred in Las Vegas, Charles Barkley promised not to gamble again, but this week it was learned that he's not exactly a man of his word, or is he?
He's going to gamble for charity. He's in a celebrity poker tournament in conjunction with 2008 World Series of Poker in July, Ante Up for Africa, which is designed to raise money and awareness for the crisis in Darfur. Where do you go with this? It's not a good idea for Charles to put a nickel in a parking meter right now, but it's very hard to argue that somebody's going to use this addiction he has to benefit, you know, destitute people around the world. It's a very tough dilemma.
It was learned recently that an American woman stranded and presumed dead in the Austrian Alps devised a very ingenious plan to attract a rescue party. Charlie, are you impressed by the resourcefulness of Jessica Brown?
First of all, I give this warning periodically to our listeners. Yes, you are listening to a sports show. Honest to God, there'll be real sports on this show, and we'll talk about it again soon.
Like all pitchers, we like to go with a change of pace every once in a while.
Yes, I know, but this one has gone completely over the line into I'm glad Jessica Brown is doing well now. She was given up for dead by her rescuers, but she was found when she threw her bra into a cable car. Now, bras do not fall from the sky in mountainous regions very often, so it was determined, hey, somebody's getting our attention. And lo and behold, they were.
And finally, Charlie, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation will hold a hockey jingle contest because it has lost the right to the theme song for Hockey Night in Canada. So are you going to be taking part?
This is a huge story, by the way, if you haven't been following this. This is as traumatic an event among the sports fans of Canada as I can't even. It would be like ESPN going off the air in the United States. They're going to write a new jingle. I certainly think that there's a big opening here for the Zambonis, the official rock and roll band of Only a Game.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. Of course, he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks very much, Charlie.
Oh, look out! It's a lingerie squall!
We write the songs to make the whole ring sing. We write the songs to make the whole ring sing. We write the songs to make the whole ring sing.
John Feinstein's most recent book is Living on the Black, subtitled Two Pitchers, Two Teams, One Season to Remember. The season, 2007, was especially memorable for one of the pitchers, Tom Glavin, because he won his 300th game that year. Mike Messina, the other pitcher, is creeping toward that mark. Nice picks by John Feinstein, who joins me now from his home. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Bill, good to talk to you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. When you presented the idea for this book to Tom Glavin and Mike Messina, did you tell them that they were not your first choice?
Actually, I did, to be honest. I explained the entire situation to them, that I had talked to David Cohn several years earlier about the possibility of doing a book like this, and that unfortunately for me, I had encountered one of the very few Major League Baseball players who actually read The New Yorker, and as a result, he had committed to Roger Angel to do a book, and that I learned from that book that if I wanted to do a book on a year in the life of a pitcher, I probably ought to have two of them, since that particular season, David was injured most of the year, mm-hmm. and that made the book rather difficult to do, even for Roger Angel. So that's why I wanted two pitchers, and you know, the contrasts were good too, a lefty, a righty, a college grad, a non-college grad, American leaguer, national leaguer, Yankee Met. So yes, I was completely honest with them.
The title of the book, Living on the Black, refers to the fact that Glavin, Messina, and most other successful pitchers try to throw the ball over the black borders of home plate rather than over the plate itself, which is, of course, white. When you came up with that title, did you worry at all that most baseball fans already know most pitchers try to avoid throwing it over the middle of the plate?
You know, the funny thing is, a number of people, including my agent and my editor, said, "What the heck is the black?"
So I withdraw the question. Yeah. It was
so
perfect.
I actually had the opposite problem. Mm. And the argument I made was, it'll give me a good talking point to explain when the book comes out how the great pitchers, especially those who don't overpower people, and Glavin and Messina have never overpowered anybody, do have to live on the black. So I guess the answer to your question is no, I wasn't that concerned.
Now, you talked about contrasts between these two pitchers, but the two pitchers with whom you spent the 07 season are both unusual for several reasons. They're much more successful, of course, than most pitchers have been. They're both educated, and they're both articulate, and by baseball standards, they're both really old. Which, if any, of these critical factors were you thinking about when you chose your subjects?
Smart and old. To be honest. The successful, as you said, is obvious, and there are lots of successful pitchers who I could have approached. But I like the fact that these were two of the brightest guys I'd met in sports. As you said, one of them, Messina, graduated from Stanford in 3.5 years. Glavin didn't go to college, but he was a National Merit Scholar and actually wanted to go to Harvard and play hockey when he was in high school. But he, quote-unquote, only had 1150 on his SATs. And as you know, Bill, 99.9% of the colleges in America would send a limo for an athlete with 1150 on their on their SATs. But Harvard is a little bit different, and he didn't get in, and that's why he ended signing with the Braves. I also like the old aspect because I wanted guys, A, who'd had a lot of experience, but B, had been forced to adapt and evolve as they got older, because you change as an athlete when you get into your late 30s, and in Glavin's case, early 40s. You can't throw as hard. You're not in as good a shape. Your body changes. Your arm changes as a pitcher, what it can do. Messina had to change what he was doing during the 2007 season because he got yanked from the rotation for a while because he was pitching so poorly. And Glavin had had a complete makeover as a pitcher, going from a guy who pitched strictly on the outside corner to a guy who pitched inside and outside because batters had figured him out.
John, you refer it several times to, quote, the number that cannot be named. Would it be fair to characterize Tom Glavin as superstitious?
Is he a baseball player?
Exactly.
I mean, they're all superstitious in one form or another. And I began to notice when I was playing back tapes of our conversations, which dated back to the end of the 2007 season, that he never said the number 300. It was always what I'm trying to do, where I'm trying to get, what my goal is. And that's when I started referring to it at the 300 number as the Voldemort of numbers, because all the relief pitchers in the Mets clubhouse did the same thing. They were so superstitious. They would say, well, we know we're trying to get Tom, but they never said we're trying to get Tom to 300 wins. Once he got to 300 wins, then there were shirts given out that said Glavin 300 on them.
The 300th win certainly made the season especially memorable for Tom Glavin, but does season to remember, part of your title, really accurately apply to Mike Messina?
Yes, it does, because it was the worst season of his career. And focusing, I think, more on his failures than his successes, which I think a lot of successful people in sports do. They focus on the losses and how to get better rather than on the wins. Because as Bob Knight once said to one of his players, I don't need to tell you about your strengths. I'm happy with them. Yes, it's very much a season he has remembered. And if you look at the way he's pitching this year, Bill, where he's got 10 wins before the All-Star break, I think that last season is a major reason why he's pitching so well. Because Joe Torre, then the Yankees manager, sat him down when he pulled him out of the rotation after he'd started 498 consecutive games in the major leagues over almost 17 years and said, Mike, you got to learn to pitch differently. You can't strike people out anymore the way you used to. You have to learn to pitch to contact, in other words, letting the hitters put the ball in play rather than nibbling and falling behind 2-0, 3-1, and then coming in on hitters' counts and getting crushed, which is what he was doing at that point.
At one point, after he had won his 299th game, Glavin, who has made millions of dollars playing baseball, grumbles about the fact that he can't write off for tax purposes the cost of tickets that he's buying for family and friends to come and see what he hopes will be the 300th win. He'd also referred to an offer of a $9 million one-year contract as, quote, a joke. Were you tempted ever to say, hey, man, shut up and pitch?
Well, you know, I think we were all tempted to do that with athletes who are making so much money that it feels like it's monopoly money. But when he's talking about the $9 million offer from the Atlanta Braves back in 2002, the point he was making was that that was what he had been paid the previous 5 years, and he had pitched extremely well. As far as the grumbling about the tickets and the taxes, part of that was him joking to some degree. But as Stan Kasten, the former president of the Braves, pointed out to Tom and to me, there's kind of a little bit of a dichotomy in that Tom has been a very strong union guy throughout his baseball career, but he always votes Republican to get those lower taxes.
Tom Glavin is currently on the disabled list. He may be there for another month, and it's the second time he's been on the disabled list this season. He's only won a couple of games. Mike Messina is having another very good year for a team that's struggling, at least presently. Are you following these guys pretty closely this season?
Yes, I've actually been kind of in constant touch with them, partly because of the book coming out and them being curious how the book was doing, how it was being received. And obviously, I wanted their feedback on the book when they had a chance to read it. Messina's comment was, "This is really long."
Well, it didn't take much to notice that. I must say I agree with it.
I said, "You graduated from Stanford. You ought to be able to read the darn thing." But yeah, I actually just spoke to Glavin yesterday about his condition with his left elbow. And he said, as you pointed out, that it'll be at least the All-Star break before he can come back. And I've been asking Messina constantly since he blamed me for his poor season last year if I got any credit at all for the fact that maybe this might be the first year in his career finally when he wins 20 games. And his answer to me was, no, this is like marriage. You get blame but not credit.
John Feinstein's most recent book is Living on the Black, Two Pitchers, Two Teams, One Season to Remember. It's published by Little Brown. He spoke with me from his home in Maryland. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Bill, thanks for having me again. I appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jim Doyle, Martha Biebinger, Kurt Nickisch, Andrea Shea, and Sarah Bush. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from John Feinstein, who, after the Celtics won their 17th championship, recalled the special dispensation granted by the city of Boston to the subject of one of Feinstein's books, The Late Red Auerbach.
There was a city ordinance in Boston banning smoking in all public buildings except for Arnold Red Auerbach during Celtics games.
Rumors that Red also didn't have to stop at red lights have been highly exaggerated. Of course, nobody in Boston stops at red lights. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.